Hello and welcome to Boss Madle, where I sit down and get real with some pretty amazing creative women entrepreneurs. So grab yourself a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and get ready to be inspired. Hello everyone and welcome to Boss Madle. Today I sit down with Bracha Hanemetzker, who is a Chabad Shlucha emissary, as well as the creator of Gotham Fairy Tales, an Instagram account where she takes us on historical and design tours of Manhattan, as well as her adventures in nature. And she shares with us the different show houses she visits, design shops. She talks about art and culture and shows us beautiful trails in the Catskills. So it's a really interesting, multifaceted account that I urge you all to check out. One of the themes that we talk about in our interview is curiosity, the importance of expanding our horizons, of getting curious, of staying curious. As wives and mothers, we can often get sucked into, you know, the drudgery of life, but it's so important to find something that sparks joy in us, to follow our passion, to really try something new, whether that's reading a new book or going to a new place. And I came across this quote online that says, "Curiosity is a spark behind the spark of every great idea. The future belongs to the curious." So I just love that. And I am sure you're going to love this interview today. We talk about so many important points. So without further ado, I'm going to dive right in and introduce Bracha Hana. Bracha Hana Metzger was born a tour guide, nature lover, and interior designer. A Brooklyn native, this mother and wife resides in Manhattan, where she has served as a shlucha to Chabad of Midtown since 1996. In her capacity as shlucha, she frequently lectures on Judaic topics specializing in the history of the Jews of Newark. Her Insta blog at Gotham Fairy Tales has been growing in popularity since starting in the spring of 2018. Her commentary gives her a platform to share her nature photography, city secrets, history, home decor, as well as her inside knowledge of the local interior design scene. Bracha Hana, welcome to the show. Hi, Bracha Hana. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm so glad to finally be talking to you in person after following you for a while.
I know. We had a really nice, conversations on Instagram. It's a great way to connect to people. And I really feel like you and I are soul sisters, in a sense, design soul sisters. And we share very similar passions for certain things. You actually describe yourself as a photojournalist, a naturalist, a curator, historian, and interior designer by nature. And of course, you're a wife, mom, and a shlucha. For those who don't know what a shlucha is, it's a Chabad emissary or a rebbetzin. Is that a fair description?
Yes. So I will add that that's by pretty much by default. It wasn't my original plan, but God knows what he's doing. Let's put it that way. We'll get to that.
Interesting. Okay. So yes, can you tell us a little bit about your role as a Chabad shlucha and, how you started with that and then kind of how you fell into these other passions and interests of yours?
Right. Well, actually the passions and interests came first.
Okay.
I as a little kid in camp, we would have a day off and my friends would go and buy magazines like Vogue and whatever. And I thought that was cool, but I had my own style from a very young age. And if I was going to buy a magazine, it was going to be Architectural Digest. And this is as an 11-year-old, you know? So it was always a passion of mine. I always used to redesign my parents' house in my head. There are pictures from when I was 10 years old, drawing houses and staircases and chandeliers and et cetera. I also have a tremendous memory for a space. So I remember my grandmother's house and how a room makes you feel. And the belief that your environment has tremendous influence over your emotions, over your thought patterns, etc. So I was very much always influenced by my surroundings and always thought of how I could fix it and make it better. I think that came first. And then I grew up in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, which is a Chabad community. Many people we knew were either on shlichas or had kids or relatives on shlichas. My parents were both in chinuch, which is, you know, Jewish education. And I had friends who said from day one, I want to marry someone who will go on shlichas. I want to go on shlichas, which is, you know, when Chabad is sent all over the world to open Chabad houses and institutions to bring Jews closer to Yiddishkeit and their roots and to provide a Jewish environment. I always had tremendous admiration for it. But I never occurred to me that that was something I could do or should do. And I always thought, I'm going to be an interior designer. Or a historian, a curator, as you mentioned before. I put that in, because I'm also a natural tour guide. And everybody should know their strengths, and I knew those were mine. What's interesting is we have hidden strengths that we discover on the path of life. So when I was dating my husband, he said he wanted to open a Chabad in Manhattan. And he was also already sort of on that path. He was already doing Jewish nonprofit advertising. And he had an organization called the Chai Foundation, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe would often edit his ads that he would submit. And he has the Rebbe's what's called the Ksav Yad. And honestly, I was surprised to find myself so admiring of him and what he was doing, and that he was already, he was young, but he was doing such meaningful work. And then a whole flip side opened up to me that you can be both, because he was very much the type who went to museums and was interested in world history and very knowledgeable. But at the same time, he wanted to be on Shlichas and do the work that he felt it was his calling. So I definitely liked him. Let's put it that way. So Hashem has a plan. And sure. Initially I was very hesitant. I thought, yes, I did grow up in Crown Heights, which is open to many types of people. And I met all kinds of people from backgrounds that were very different from mine, that weren't necessarily religious or even Jewish. And on Shabbatons and what's called Pegishas, my parents had an open home. And we entertained people from all different backgrounds. But it's a different story, leaving home and being in another environment and feeling like you have the tools. In school, I was not the most attentive student. I was always a big reader, and I did okay, but I was often in the back of the classroom reading a book. So I thought I may not have gleaned enough in Beis Rivka to go out there, but what's incredible is we don't know our own strengths. And sure. Over the years, it's been 23 years, I learned not only that we have much more than we think we have to give. And that what the Lubavitcher Rebbe taught was, if you know Aleph, teach Aleph. And that is something I live by every single day, that a lot of people hesitate to try to teach spirituality or religion to others, thinking I'm not perfect. But guess what? Nobody is. And you, there's something you know that someone else doesn't know. And the rewards that we get from sharing that is for them and for ourselves as well. So I've learned that. And the other thing I learned is whatever talents you have, you can use them in wherever you end up. You know, it's not, I may not be an interior designer, but I use my aesthetic skills for so much in at Chabad. So I get to do both. And now with Instagram, I get to have a platform for some of that.
Yes. Yes. So true. I also, you know, I wanted to talk to you about this, but one of the core beliefs I think that we were raised with as Chabad women is that your talents are not mutually exclusive of living a spiritual life. I think I'd actually wrote this on Instagram. We had a conversation about how I first found my first design job in Soho, and how I came to New York. I had no leads. I signed up at FIT to study interior design. I had to find a job, and I was walking around Soho. And I walked into this showroom, and there was a huge picture of the Chabad Lubavitcher Rebbe on the wall smiling down at me. And right away, I just blurted out. I'm like, oh, wow. And so the owner perked up and said, what? And I'm like, oh, that's my Rebbe. And he said, no kidding. And we started talking, and then I found out he was Moroccan, and I'm from Montreal. We started speaking French, and he offered me a job on the spot. He wasn't even looking for someone, and I just felt like that was, you know, the Rebbe's way of saying, you know, you clearly have an interest in something or a talent in something, you know, go for it. And I love how you seamlessly combine on Instagram your love of design and history and Judaism and outreach. And I think it's a really beautiful concept.
Yes. By the way, I'm so glad that people are getting to hear your end of the story and how your actually your religion is what promoted your talent in a sense. Like you got that job because the picture of the Rebbe was there. It's an unbelievable thing.
Yeah.
And it's not miraculous as much as in there's no contradiction. There's always synergy that you can find. And this applied to the Rebbe when the Rebbe did Farbrengens, which is when he gave over speeches on Torah and on spirituality, it was put on cable TV, and many people were like, "But cable TV is full of things that shouldn't be seen and that are definitely not kosher." And the Rebbe said, "No, I want to use that platform to show it could be used for good, and that applies to almost anything." I realized that when I started, let's say I'm very into nature, mm-hmm. when I started going on hikes and realizing that many people live city lives. Hundreds of years ago, people lived agricultural lives. As a matter of fact, a huge percentage of the mitzvos in the Torah are agriculture based. And today we're so distant from it. And when you go out there into the woods or on top of a mountain, obviously, we're not meant to live that way all the time. That's not practical. We're meant to bring God into every day. But I want to tell you, on top of a mountain, you truly do feel closer to God.
Yes.
It's an incredible experience. And I say, in one hand, in my city life, I bring people who are already hikers closer to God.
Right.
And I feel like when I get people who are from the religious community who never were into nature, and when I get them out there into nature, I'm sort of, it's integrated into life, and they say, wow. And it's very important emotionally, socially, on every level to commune with nature. It's returning to our roots and a time before, the land before time, as they call it, Bereshit, right? The world was created. And we've lost touch in many ways with our natural selves, our natural environment. And that's okay, provided we once in a while get out there. But this is Hashem. It's important to see the world as Hashem created it.
Right.
Once in a while, go to a place so that's a preserve that they've preserved as Hashem created the world. And it's a miraculous thing. I live in one of the most built up environments anywhere in the world. Here's a naturalist living in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah.
And again, a girl who wanted to be a designer, a Chabad shlucha. At first, I almost felt like I would have to turn around and look when someone said Rebbetzin. And as you grow older, you realize it's not being boastful in any way to say, I am a shlucha, or I am an interior designer, or whatever it is, the position you're in, giving yourself a title. It's not. It's actually a responsibility. I could take whatever talent or whatever title or whatever role I have and use it in service of the community or to help teach other people and ourselves something.
Yes. You know, we both share a passion for history and design. And in addition to showing, you know, beautiful settings in nature, you also make for a fabulous tour guide. I mean, you show us around Soho, you take us to one of the oldest buildings. I think it's built in like 1818. That was the One Kings Lane building, right? And
yes.
You take us around Murray Hill. So for listeners who are not familiar with your Instagram account, basically you have Insta stories that kind of take us around all these neighborhoods, and you show us these fascinating homes and architecture, and you just tell us about the history behind what we're seeing. What made you decide to do these tours, and where did you get all this vast wealth of knowledge?
Well, I've always been a big reader. My parents, despite having been what's called FFB from birth, mm-hmm. Were always very open-minded. They took us to libraries to take out books. They took us on nature trails. They took us to museums. They always read history books. And so that affinity, I don't know if it's nature or nurture, but it was always there. Part of why I do Gotham Fairy Tales, which is my Instagram account, and I actually, this is a little secret, I do it under my maiden name because it's my public account. I have a private account as well where I talk about my private life, my family, my children, my Chabad work. But this I did as a separate account because I've met people on the trails. I've met people in places who said, you know what, you have so much knowledge, you should share it. And I enjoy that platform to share my knowledge on stuff that's outside of my Chabad work. So that's my little getaway. And the reason I don't do it under my married name is because there are people out there that might be, that I feel as a security issue, as a Chabad, because there has been so many incidents that were vulnerable. I don't want them to know exactly where I live, so I don't show the outside of my house. I'll say I live in Midtown Manhattan. I don't say exactly where I work, but I will reference it. So for those in the know and know what Chabad is, I might occasionally mention it. But I don't get too specific. My goal with Gotham Fairy Tales is to open people's eyes to what's around them. Many people will walk around the neighborhood in Manhattan and think, oh, this is cool. How did it get to be this way? Context adds such a layer of richness to everything. And I do this wherever I go. My sister lived in Melbourne, Australia. I had to research the history first. Everywhere you go, it adds such a layer of interest. And then buildings are no longer just buildings. They tell a story. And that sort of segues into the design passion that I have, sure. Where interiors, exteriors, buildings, rooms have personalities and have histories and have futures. And I see it all as very connected. The same thing with nature. So there really is no contradiction. I love the seamless blending of all these parts of life. Now, again, it's not completely seamless because I can't go out there and say exactly where I live and what I do mm-hmm. in this world that's become a little insane in some ways, like, you know, with terrorism and everything. And we do have to hesitate. Sure. And be careful. My children couldn't believe it when I said I remember as a kid going straight up to the airplane gate. Like, you didn't have to take off your shoes. You didn't have to go through all these things. So, you know, you do have to be mindful of the fact that the world has evolved, sometimes positively and sometimes not, and meaningful of that. But there are many other ways that you can seamlessly integrate history, design, architecture, into your Jewish life. And there is this concept of people like leading a very insular life, but I'm very grateful to be Chabad.
Yeah.
And not because it's better, but because we are given permission in a sense, to use any skills, any history, any knowledge for positive growth. And to share with others. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe himself, there wasn't a subject he wasn't familiar with. You know, mathematics, history, and in addition to an incredible wealth of Torah knowledge. And I think that's why the Rebbe was able to be the Rebbe. And that is why the Rebbe was able to guide so many people. Now, I'm not pretending to be the Rebbe. What I'm saying is that there really is no contradiction. Any knowledge can be used for positivity. I always think of the Rambam, Maimonides. He was a doctor, but he wrote some of the most prolific Judaic texts that we know and still study today. It's interesting to note that the Rambam was considered controversial at first, maybe for those reasons, but today he's widely accepted and it's encouraged to learn Rambam. So it's not always easy. People might look at you like you're different, but that doesn't mean you should hesitate to use all this anything tools in your arsenal for good.
Yes, it's interesting. I have a terrible time fasting on Yom Kippur and other fasts. And, you know, I spoke to many rabbis about it. And when I spoke to, there's this one Chabad rabbi who is a proper Rav, very, very religious. He's also an acupuncturist and I think a naturopath.
Wow.
The first time that someone explained to me what my body's doing during a fast, what I shouldn't be doing, what I should be doing, he fully understood. It was like this aha moment where I'm like, I'm understood. And he was fantastic. And of course, all within the guidelines of halacha, Jewish law, but you could Incredible. Tell that his knowledge only helped to, you know, make him, you know, understand what I was going through.
That's incredible. You see, so he's using his medical knowledge to rule halachically and also to explain to you. You can't, it's hard to help people if you don't have you need to consider the full person. And when you have knowledge in other areas as a rabbi, especially, you can use that in to help others. It's interesting. My husband told me that the Sanhedrin, the Jewish, let's say, board of rabbis of 2,000 years ago, those who were on the Sanhedrin of the Jewish elders, they were called, had to have knowledge of a vast number of subjects. They had to have medical knowledge. They had to have knowledge of astronomy. They had to have knowledge of agriculture, nature, so many fields in order for them to do halachic Judaic rulings. It's yes. incredible when you think about that. And yet you have certain schools of thought which say you should only be learning XYZ. But if you open a Gemara or a lot of different mefarshim and different tractates, etc., they will go into other subjects. And that, again, like the history of the buildings or the neighborhoods, adds a layer of context to everything. And that rabbi that you spoke to, you could listen to him because you knew he had authority. And that is such a gift.
Correct. Yes, that's exactly it. So I actually want to ask you something. Well, going back to what we said about the history, because I'm fascinated by this one particular story that you did about the old cemeteries. I thought it was amazing that way back when we didn't even fathom that there were Jews, you know, thriving and living their lives in America. There were, and they left a trail through Manhattan. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, this is fascinating. I was surprised by the amount of feedback I got when I posted the three historic Sherith Israel cemeteries that literally are on Manhattan Island. They're one of like four cemeteries that are like below Central Park mm-hmm. in Manhattan, three of which are Jewish ones. It's actually fascinating. And they go back, the first Sherith Israel cemetery is on the Lower East Side, or, you know, on the border of Chinatown. And it is actually dates from 1680. And I showed on Gotham Fairy Tales a map from the time that area was undeveloped. And all you see on it, it says Jews burying grounds. And what's incredible about it is that the synagogue was down in Lower Manhattan, and Wall Street was then the border of the Isle of Manhattan, or the city of New Amsterdam. Wow. And they built this michutz lamachaneh, because Jews tend to build cemeteries outside of the encampment for health reasons, by the mm-hmm. way. There is this theory that groundwater can be contaminated by burying people there, and you see that very often. You have to protect the living from dead bodies. And in Jewish law, very often that is a mandate of protecting the living. And life, and that's the most important, but you see it right there in history. And the reason I started researching Jewish history on the island of Manhattan is not just because I live there. Many people live there aren't familiar. I was thinking New York City has the largest population of Jews outside of Israel.
Right.
And some say in the world, like, because Jerusalem is a smaller city. So how did it get to be this way? And there you go. There's the layers of history, which explains what's going on today. And if you hear about the story of how the Jewish settlers had to leave Brazil because of the Spanish Inquisition, and then the Portuguese came in, and how they ended up in New York, and how Peter Stuyvesant tried to throw them out. But the Dutch West Indies Company, East Indies Company said, no, our backers are Jewish. And how back in Amsterdam, Jews were very much a part of society. So right. You see all the connections. It's like a connect the dot leading up to today. So the history is very much relevant.
It's incredible.
And when you, oftentimes, if you're fighting for civil rights or religious rights, you can refer back to those times as a reference for the future. And Gemara does that all the time.
Wow.
And halacha.
Yeah. So again, for listeners who are not familiar, you have to check out Gotham Fairy Tales. We'll include the link in our show notes. And there are these just fascinating tours. And so you'll see one of Soho, and you'll see one of Murray Hill. And then there's one of these three old cemeteries. And it's brilliant. It really is.
Well, I'll tell you where they are. A lot of people drive past them. They're tiny and aren't even aware. Possibly if you walk by, you're more likely to see it. But mm-hmm. One of them is on the Lower East Side. The second Sheirith Israel Cemetery is from the early 1800s. It's actually in the West Village. I love Greenwich Village. I did a history on that. I got the most likes on my Greenwich Village history.
Oh, interesting.
Right there on West 11th Street, in the middle of all these beautiful, charming townhouses, is a tiny little triangle. The street was cut through. This area had originally been undeveloped when the cemetery began.
Wow.
And the street was cut through, and they left, they moved the gravestones over, and it's in this little triangle on the south side of West 11th Street. The third Sheirith Israel Cemetery, it's funny, when I posted it, someone mentioned to me, oh, I've passed, and I wondered what that was about, because there is a plaque, but it doesn't tell you the history. So 21st Street has the third Sheirith Israel Cemetery, and that's from the 1850s. That area eventually became Ladies Mile, and all the big department stores in the late 1800s were there. And ladies in their Victorian ball gowns would walk by. And somehow this little cemetery thankfully survived right off where you have, the area has had a resurgence, and New York is like that.
Right, of course.
Very cyclical, neighborhoods go out of fashion. If you look at Brooklyn now, when I first moved to Manhattan, I was almost embarrassed to say I was from Brooklyn. It was like stigmatized. It's like saying you're from Cleveland or New Jersey, you know?
Yes.
Now you go to Europe and people are wearing sweatshirts that say Brooklyn. So everything comes around.
Sure.
And when Ladies Mile came around, now you have like Old Navy and Bed Bath & Beyond and TJ Maxx and other nicer stores, some designer stores in the area, many of them. And it's amazing. That little cemetery is witness to all these changes. And it's our people. Our people have been in New York since the 1600s, before the English went there, before many of the multitudes came. It was a tiny little town, and the Jews were there.
It's amazing. It mm-hmm. really, really is. One day, I would love to do a design and history tour with you.
I would love to do that too. So far, people have asked me to do it, and honestly, I've done it for Chabad groups, because other shluchas have said, can you come and tell my women about the history of the Jewish history of Manhattan? And then they start asking me questions about the other history. And it's really interesting to see the way the city of Manhattan in general built up from lower Manhattan, the tip of Manhattan, moved north on the island, how Central Park is central to New York being New York,
mm-hmm.
How the Hudson River was a portal to the world, in a sense. So all this is what makes New York, New York, the greatest city in the world, supposedly, right?
Yes.
And somehow I ended up in the middle of it.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the main things you chronicle, as well as history, as I mentioned before, is design. Can you tell me who are some of your favorite designers and what are some of your favorite shops in New York?
I'd have to say, well, I'll start with the shops. John Darien's shop, particularly his original shop on the Lower East Side, is Decoupage, Astier de Villat that he customized, which is a type of beautiful porcelain from Paris.
Yes, that was the one store I made myself crazy to go to in Paris. We had a short stopover, and I made the taxi driver nuts. And he's like, for plates? What are you making me crazy for?
We are a rare breed, but I love that you're a kindred spirit, and I totally get that. And I think you are crazy, but I am too, because this is important, just as important as other things are to other people.
Yes.
So I totally get that. So John Darien is so much fun, because never know what you're going to find there. It's, you know, when people say, what is your style? Is it traditional? Is it modern? It's everything.
Yes.
I particularly love the mix, because as I was telling you, historic items, throw one antique into a modern room. Have fun. Give people something to look at or think about. Make them feel comfortable in a room. A layered room is much more comfortable than a stark, cold room. So it's not a matter of modern or traditional. Good taste is good taste. And a lot of people are scared. I've had people come into my house and say, like, you weren't scared to paint it that color. You weren't scared. You can change paint.
So true.
Yes. But be brave. I can't afford to do what I would do if I was the interior designer I was going to be. But you would be amazed how you can reconstitute things. And by the way, that's being very green. Recycling, buying an antique, painting it, changing a fabric, reupholstering things, moving things around even. is a way of making things interesting. Collecting is yes. a big thing of mine. It makes a home personal. You don't want your home to look like a doctor's office, a pretty doctor's office, as nice as it might be, or, you know, or any type of office. You don't want your home to look like a commercial space or an academic space. You want it to look like a home. And so people have asked me for design advice, and I always tell them, make it your own. I think that's the ultimate, and make it comfortable, that people sit down in a room, there's a comfortable place to sit. There's pretty things to look at, and it should be a room you don't want to get up and leave. Unless you don't want any company.
Yes. And it should really showcase your personality and your interests. Yes. You know, I think
I always say, do you want people to think you don't have personality?
So true.
Give your room a personality. Or do you want to talk to a person who has nothing to say? Do you want to be in a room that has nothing to say? A room can tell a story, and use that concept to collect things, move things around, inject color.
Yes.
Pattern. Don't be afraid. Most things can be changed. If you want to go with some basic large pieces and then change up the throw pillows, change up an inexpensive rug or the wall hangings. Don't leave your walls bare. Don't walk out of the house without clothes. Don't stay in the house without it being dressed. Don't walk around naked. Don't leave your rooms naked.
Yes. Oh, so well said. Do you have a favorite color at the moment, or any, you know, palette or some colors that you would love, you know, listeners to maybe try or explore?
I love blue in all its variations. And that's probably one of the most favorite colors.
Universally, beloved.
I love blue. One of the reasons I might love blue, though, is because I live in Midtown Manhattan, and from my house, you cannot see the sky. And I love the sky. I could watch the sky all day. So in the summer, I like to go upstate. I go back and forth a lot. Very often for Shabbos, I'll be in Manhattan. But the way I got to that, my family has been summering in the Catskills, the Barsh Belt, since the 1940s. They came to America, and they were told, basically, in the summer, you have to go to the mountains.
Right.
And so this was a family tradition. When I was a kid, I lived from summer to summer, basically, just to go to the country, as we called it. Mm-hmm. And it was, we still do. But what helped me pursue more of my interests and made me realize that it's important to use your talents and your interests when you can, and not to push it off and say later, when my kids are grown, when I have less work, do it now. I lost my sister to leukemia 5 years ago, and there were so many things I talked to her about, mm-hmm. and we discussed, and she thinks she made fun of me about, like hobby. She used to say, you write like you're writing a book. I'm your sister. You don't have to write like that. She was cute the way sisters are.
Sure.
And other areas she would say, wow, you're so talented. And I remember when she was in the hospital in Sloan Kettering in New York, I was making, beautiful Shalach Manos packages, Purim packages for our Chabad friends and people. And I brought it to show her. And I remember her saying, Bruch, you're amazing. You're so talented. You should, you know, I hope you use this a lot. And I took burlap bags and had it printed with Chabad on it. And it was a Sunday. So I made it into a Sunday brunch, and I put in granola and all these things. And after we lost her, I was like, she was 49. I was 42 at the time. Oh, and I said, the time is now. Hashem gives us, look, hopefully we'll live to 100. And when you lose someone young close to you, it definitely reminds you that you're mortal. But more than that, it actually in many ways inspired me to follow what interests me, because I realized there was so much that she put off and that she could have done that she may not have. And a lot of times when we think we're prioritizing, it's important to prioritize. Obviously, my children, Chabad, my husband come before interior design.
Sure.
You know, but you can pursue your hobbies and your interests and do all of that. And it's just important to make time for that. And it taught me that lesson. also, she was very encouraging, like I said, especially when she was sick. And I said, I was holding on to, you know, all the advice she was giving me. And there, she was my oldest sister. And she was like my little mommy. And every day of my life, there are aspects of her, I can almost hear her voice. Because from the youngest age, she was, again, like my little mommy and taught me so much. And she's really an inspiration. Now, she was not into nature. She was not into interior design, but she was a huge book, a book mouse like me. Mm-hmm. We always had our head in books. We would talk about what we were going to read. We're both natural editors. You give me a paper, I'll give it back to you filled with red crossings, etc. So we had certain things in common, but I really thank her for all her guidance and for reminding me that the different aspects of life can all be integrated and should be now. Don't wait.
Yes. You know, first of all, I can't even imagine, or, you know, what that must have been like. I have two sisters and I'm very close to them. And you know, what you did say about the idea of learning how to, you know, not procrastinate and to really go for things, you know, because of what you experienced. It reminds me of something I heard very early on as a young mom when I had two toddlers. And I was listening to this mom podcast and they said, don't wait for your house to be perfectly clean to get your kids out of the house and start your day, because it won't happen. And the day will pass you by and the weeks will pass you by. And yes, you can do laundry forever. And if you've got toddlers, they will mess that up in 2 seconds. Get out, go to the park, enjoy time with them. And I'm so happy I heard that advice, because you could get so stuck in your, I have to go to the cleaners and I have to do my laundry and I have to prep dinner and I have to. But then it's, what's life about? It's all the have to's and not what you want to do, what you feel passionate about, or, you know, where you really come alive. And last question before we get into some of our, you know, the fun little questions that are your favorites, what keeps you driven and excited each day? You have this amazing energy and you're in so many various places and you're doing so many things. What keeps you motivated and energized?
I would say stay curious, and that's really my secret. I'm hungry, as I mentioned, to grow my mind. So I have never been bored a day in my life. I have people who are like, oh, I'm so bored, there's nothing to do. Oh my God, look at the world. It's filled with things to do. Today, yeah. Should I hike? Should I do aquatherapy for my bad back? Should I do something practical? Or impractical, but there's so much to see and do. There's not enough time in a day. So I that's really what keeps me going. And once in a while, it's okay to not go somewhere and to have a day indoors. But then there's a book to read and a person to call. There's always someone to reach out to. And I have to remind myself that, because I am all over the place. And last week, during the 9 days, I was reading about what's called the daily Hayom Yom, that the previous Lubavitcher wrote Hayom Yom, which is daily inspiration. And it said it's the 9 days and we have to increase in our Avos Yisrael and reaching out to other people. And I remember I was here upstate, and we have an elderly Holocaust survivor in my community. And I realized that Friday before, I usually call her, I hadn't called her. And so I said, I'm doing it right now. That's another thing. It's like, if I push it off, I'm not going to remember. And it's sometimes hard to speak to her because she complains a lot. So I pushed myself, and you go out of your comfort zone. And also I try to do that, to reach out to someone once a day. I have to, it's a discipline, because I'm not naturally like that. Some people are naturally worried about other people the whole day. I'm too busy wanting to learn history and wanting to do art. But that's also a very important thing to incorporate. To remember other people.
Yes.
And that's what also keeps me grounded, in a sense. Our responsibility to others.
Yes. I think your message applies to, you know, so many women, because we always often talk about, you know, building a business, and I interview a lot of entrepreneurs, but there are a lot of listeners who are stay-at-home moms. And this idea of what you're saying of staying curious, of you know, leading a very interesting full life. That is regardless of whether you are at home or in an office or building a business or not building a business and have no interest in doing that. But really, it's about the idea of finding yourself, finding what makes you tick, opening and expanding your horizons, and just going for something, whatever that may be. So,
and ultimately, it's a gift to your child to pursue your interests and your talents.
Yes. Oh, yes.
It is. At the end of the day, a happy mommy makes happy kids. Kids are very much in tune with their parents. A mother who spends her morning to night in the drudgery of parenthood, because let's be honest, there's the minutiae that's annoying, and it's part of being a mother, but make sure to either take some mommy time or, again, like we were discussing, grow your mind, pursue some interests. I have a library at home of books on old New York. As mentioned, I love the history. When I have a moment or two, I'll sit down and look at that. First of all, when your kids see you reading or pursuing your habits, you're teaching them that it's good to have interests outside of what must be done today. It's healthy and it's good. But also, you'll be happier and you'll be a better parent at the end of the day. By the way, now I see my kids on their own. They're pulling out these books and looking at them. So it's just nice to have that. And that applies to Jewish books especially. The Lubavitcher Rebbe always encouraged people, bayis malei svarim, house filled with svarim. Even if you're not a learner per se, let them be there. One day your kid might pick it up. And one of my sons is like that. One is not. It's interesting how, as a parent, they're, you know, same two parents, each a different world, but have the things around, whether it's history books, whether it's Jewish books, have those placemats, have maps, atlases. This way, they'll discover on their own, with what you have around them, that environment, what interests them.
Yes.
It might not be the same as what interests you, but make your house into a library where if you go to the library, there's so much. You should have a bit of a museum in your house or mm-hmm. something that will cause them to ask you questions. Mommy, where did you get this vase from?
I'm laughing because my coffee table. Okay, I've got the craziest vases from like we schlepped back from like China and Amsterdam, the Delft vases. I have like rocks from like the most randomest places. My kids love it. They think it's interesting. I mean,
that's
they don't just, and I have boys. They have not destroyed it. It's like shockingly,
wow.
But
we have a lot of porcelain that was crashed. You know, I live in an 1863 townhouse in Manhattan.
Yes.
That's what was available for the family of our size. Most of the apartments in Midtown are like one bedrooms and studios.
Right.
So I love that it has such history and old bones, like nothing new will have. But mm-hmm. at the same time, I wasn't going to make it so delicate that, you know, my kids couldn't run around. So in this grand dining room with this heavy mahogany woodwork, my kids ate their scrambled eggs and had Cheerios fights, you know? But I will tell you, some of the porcelain that I collected was shattered by my two sons throwing footballs at each other. And, you know, the cost of living, you know?
Yes.
That's what I peg it to. But don't, you know, once in a
don't
while.
Don't be too nervous about it. It's just a thing. So
right.
If it breaks,
right.
Yes.
And let them grow up around pretty things. But don't be so hesitant that, you know, your house is completely bare. And let them ask questions. They will. Believe it or not, they will. Even about design. Even the boys.
Yes. I see that with mine, for sure. Now, mind you, we have Nerf gun fights in the house, and a lot of the stuff on my coffee table are from Marshalls and Target, so if it gets broken, it's a $15 tray. You know,
home goods!
Exactly.
Home goods!
Exactly. It's about the balance. I couldn't agree more. So, we're actually down to our favorites. Here's where I ask you a couple of your favorites. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite designer?
Interior designer.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many.
Oh, bring them on.
Yeah. I love Henry & Co. They're a small, two women, New York-based, not very well known, but I love that the way they mix things up.
I've never heard of them, actually.
Yes, Henry & Co.
Okay.
They're really, really good. And then I like some of the bigger ones. I have a neighbor who I met at one of the show houses. I love going to show houses. So the designer show houses are where different designers take over different rooms and decorate them. And it's so much fun. It's so much variety. And very often you pay admission and it goes for a charitable cause, medicine, underprivileged children. And then you get to have fun and look at different environments. So almost any city in the world will have designer show houses. So I want to encourage people to go look them up. And or just Google the name of your city and designer show house, and you'd be surprised because it's a lot of fun. It's a great
experience. Yeah.
Right. And yes, my children, my youngest child is actually interested and wants to go with me. And I'm like, I have to pay $50 for my 11-year-old to go look at rooms. But guess what? I'm excited that she shares an interest with me. My other kids are not. My husband is not. So sometimes I'll go alone. I'll go with a friend if my friend has time.
One of these days, I want to meet you at the Southern Style Now show house. It's either in Charleston. I went to the first one in New Orleans, and it was insane.
Right? Southern Style Now is on my bucket list.
Yes.
You know, in general, Southern design is incredible. So I follow a lot of the Southern style. It's always so warm and so comfortable. Off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of, well, there's Melanie Turner.
Yes.
Very good.
We both like Sarah Ruffin Costello.
Yes. Love her.
Brilliant.
She's in New Orleans now. Yeah. Brilliant designer. Love her style. Leanne Thornton. She's, I think, out of Atlanta. So I do like a lot of the Southern designers because, you know, the South is famous for hospitality. Yeah. So they really know how to create a comfortable room. Very often they're a little too traditional for me, but then you throw in a contemporary New York City twist and you'll throw, you know, one of my favorite things to do is throw something modern into an old room, like a room that's more historic or traditional, or throw something antique into a very contemporary space. And that is something to go by if you're not sure which way you want to go or to just a little twist that makes things interesting. That is something anyone can incorporate. So if your home is more modern, buy an antique or two. It gives it context. It gives it a little bit weight.
Yes.
And makes it feel more homey. And if you have a very traditional home, instead of it feeling stuffy and grandma-like, you can throw in one or two more contemporary pieces or a piece of contemporary art. That always goes a very long way in freshening a room up. Or take a traditional print and blow it up. And that makes it feel more contemporary. So you can take an old-fashioned interior and make it feel more today. And that makes it fun. It's actually fun and comfortable.
Yes. A woman who does this so very well and who we both love is Kit Kemp.
Oh.
So for listeners who don't know, yes, she's a British designer who I think her husband owns most of the hotels. But
the Ferndale Hotel chain.
Yes.
And she decorates all of them. She has two hotels in New York and a whole bunch of them in London. So when I was recently in London, I made sure to visit two of her hotels. I didn't get to all of them. But she has two hotels in New York, the Crosby Street Hotel and the Whitby Hotel. It's like an amusement park for me.
Yes, same here. I couldn't stop taking pictures. My husband's like, can we sit down and have a drink now?
Right. So by the way, that's another thing. We should get into that. But as far as Kit Kemp goes, first of all, she patronizes many artists, which is a beautiful thing to do.
Yes.
She does a lot of handmade things. And believe me, you feel it and it shows. She is very into textures, fibers, beautiful fabrics, art. She mixes things up in a fantastic way. Her spaces are both comfortable and fun and interesting, and that you never want to leave. And I'm a huge fan. Someone else we're both fans of is Miles Redd.
Oh, yes.
He's incredible. He's incredible too. Also, it's like a trip to the candy store.
And he's really funny. I've heard him on podcasts. He is funny.
Yes,
he is. He does not take himself seriously.
Right. Nick Olson worked for him and is now on his own. He's fantastic too.
Yes.
They're both very, very colorful. My tip for people who are scared of color, which is like most people that I know, is to do a neutral envelope, and interject small pieces of color. Start with that.
Yes.
Paint one piece a weird color, and you might enjoy it a lot and be encouraged to do more. But definitely, you don't want a colorless life. You don't want a colorless room.
Yes. And I know that now it's very popular to do a lot of like this kind of millennial, very modern. But you know, when I worked for a very big designer in LA, she really opened my eyes to what modern was. So yes, you can have very clean lines and it's very kind of neutral, but she had different texture. She had like a concrete top table, and then she had, you know, a piece of art and an installation. So even if your taste is not super traditional or colorful, there are ways to inject a space with character and personality.
Correct. Texture,
yes.
Mainly.
Yeah.
So you and also contrast with that within the texture. So use straw with sterling silver.
Correct. You know,
and sometimes in one piece, in different pieces. So you could still keep, some people are more comfortable in a neutral envelope, but don't, make sure it doesn't lack personality in by adding different textures. Correct. Leather, straw,
plants, stone. Greenery.
Another thing is, if you're going to have a room that's all stone and hard surfaces, that won't feel comfortable. So you can have a modern space and make sure to warm it up. Two tricks that I use to warm up a space, and I do like contemporary. Mm-hmm. I live in an 1863 house, and I'm respectful of that. So you may not believe it, but I do like contemporary. And if I lived in a contemporary apartment, I would decorate it accordingly. But ways to warm up a more modern space, or a box-like space that you happen to be renting, etc., is with upholstery is one, and wood.
Yes.
So something has a lot of stone, wood feels very warm, upholstery feels very warm, or you just throw pillows, stuff like that, are ways to warm up a space.
Yes. Yes. And the upholstery can be more modern or graphic. It doesn't have to be like a toile or a chintz if that's not what you like. But
correct.
It's the idea of having an extra
something
layer.
Something soft. Something soft, literally. And wood does that as well. Another thing I want to point out is, people have asked me, like, when do you have time? When do you have time to go to all, visit all these hotel lobbies, for instance, or go to the show houses? I will point out, or even hiking. You have Chabad, you have kids. Well, I will tell you this. When my kids were very little, when I had babies, I couldn't do as much as I do now. So for those of you who have little babies that are like, sometimes feel like you're drowning in diapers and whatever, don't worry. I've been there. You try to make a little time for yourself. You're not going to be able to do everything I do, but one day, God willing, you will be.
Yes.
So I was there, and don't worry. Believe me, one day you'll be able to do more of them. In the meantime, you can be an armchair traveler. Don't sit in that armchair and space out. You could still grow your mind, as we were saying before, even if you can't get out there. Now, another thing is...
So true. There were actually years when my only exposure to interior design was when my boys would play with the train station at Barnes & Noble's. I'd get them apple juice, they'd go play with the trains, and I would get a stack of coffee table books and read them while the kids were playing with the trains. And that was that. That was my hour for the week, or my 2 hours for the week.
Right, but instead of just sitting there...
Yes.
you were pursuing your own interests. And so you're less frustrated that way, and you're a happier mommy. But I understand, like, some of you have reached out, like, when? Believe me, I was there. Secondly, as far as Chabad is concerned, I live in Manhattan, and I try to use that to my advantage, because living there is very difficult for me as someone who loves to be in nature. But I try to use Manhattan to my advantage. So one of them is pursuing the history of it. Another one is, there's so much design-wise in the city.
Yeah.
So I try to get into the D&D building or the New York Design Building. I'll make friends with interior designers who will get me in. But I also use these opportunities to call up one of my Chabad women friends and say, would you like to join me at the show house? Now, that's culture entertainment.
Yes.
And you end up having a socialized life with them, not just being the Rebbetzin, but having fun together, which is important too.
Yes.
And oftentimes, if I have a work meeting, which is all the time, I will meet with, if I'm meeting with a kala, a bride, I'll say, would you like to meet in the St. Regis lobby?
Oh, nice.
Part of the classes will start up at Chabad. We'll do one or two in my home, and I'll do some in the lobby. If I'm meeting with somebody about arranging holiday plans, I'll tell the landscape guy, I'm going to be in 56th Street. Do you want to join me at the Whitby for a drink and we'll talk about it? And, you know, these are all things you can do while you're working.
Yeah.
Not is what, you know, the Yiddish Hebrew word is astira. It's not astira. It's not a contradiction.
Yes.
And work your interests and hobbies into your work, almost any job you have.
Yes.
So try to do that as much as possible. Even hiking. We have friends from Chabad that have houses upstate. So in the summer, when I spend a lot of time upstate, mm-hmm. I'm in touch with them. I'll invite them to my house for a barbecue, which is something we never get to do in Manhattan. Or I'll say, would you like to go for a hike? And I will hike with them upstate. I would call them Balabatim hikes, which is like a funny thing, but, and they love it. And they love to see another side of the Rebbetzin, a human side.
Yes.
You know, et cetera. So that's another way I'm able to pursue my interests and use my talents for, in, you know, for Chabad and for a higher purpose. So I'm very grateful to live a life that's both very meaningful and, the, you know, using the shallower aspects for that. But I don't see these things as shallow. I don't
Correct.
See interior design as shallow and silly. I don't see fashion as silly. I think the way you you present yourself makes a huge impression on people. And I think if somebody is not religious and they're coming to you as a religious woman, and it is literally an obligation to look presentable and for your home to look presentable and your children to look presentable. Is it the most important thing? No. But can it make a very positive impression?
So, Bracha Chana, I'm considering doing a part two with you because there's so much more I'd love to talk to you about in terms of design and history. And I'm really considering maybe, you know, eventually teaming up with you to do some kind of tour. Before we go, can you share a favorite book or you know, a book that you recently read that inspired you? And then can you tell listeners where they can find you?
I don't know if this is considered kosher or not, but
oh, go for it.
My favorite book is Pride and Prejudice.
Yes.
Jane Austen, I've read all her books. I do love English literature and period pieces, and that probably relates to my love of history.
So can you tell listeners where they can find you?
So my public account, which is just fun, history, design, occasional glimpses of my family when they allow it. Mm-hmm. That's GothamFairyTales.com. It's under my maiden name, Heber. It's a name I'm very proud of, but no one can look me up in Manhattan under that name. So I feel like it's secure in this crazy world.
Yes.
So that's basically Gotham Great. Fairy Tales. Otherwise, you can make reservations and come to Chabad of Midtown. We do communal Shabbos meals. There are hundreds of hotels in the area. As a matter of fact, on the four corners of my block in Manhattan, there's one office building and three hotels.
Oh my goodness.
Not homes. There are fewer children in my neighborhood than there are in the center of Hong Kong. So it is, that part was, raising my kids was very challenging, but you know what? They're turning out okay. Baruch Hashem.
Yeah, they seem like.
You can stop by. Now every day.
I would love to come.
Please do. Now, every day at Chabad, there are things going on. There are classes. I'm not there every day. I'm out there, like I said, meeting mm-hmm. people in hotel rooms, or I'm on the...
You're at the Whitby Hotel.
Right. Yeah, find me at the Whitby. There you go.
That's a great
find
one.
Any Kit Kemp Hotel.
Yes.
You can find me. I wish I could go more often. I've been there like three times. I do, you know, have to other things to do. And very often I'm at home on the computer because a lot I have to do ordering for Chabad, etc. Some of it is giant right. technical. That's just part of almost any job in the world. But, you know, you're always welcome to stop by at Chabad. As a matter of fact, when women would come by to Chabad and have a coffee, my husband used to make a joke. He would say, are you going from Lord and Taylor to Saks Fifth Avenue? And they and one time someone left. She goes, yes, how did you know? Because he says, our Chabad women's geography was between Lord and Taylor and Saks. Never mind 42nd.
Oh, that's funny.
Third. But people stop by all day, every day. It's a very interesting place. It's the crossroads of the world. People are end up in Times Square, whether you're shopping there, people work there.
Right.
Many people that are not there to shop, there are there for work purposes or for appointments, whatever it is. We really have even policemen working the beat come in for a coffee.
That's so nice.
it's amazing who you'll meet there. Many business partnerships have happened to Chabad, some actual shidduchim. Even when I'm not there, it's a beautiful place to connect with other people. I will admit that during the week, it's more of a man's world because we have minyanim. Mm-hmm. So we have the prayer services multiple times a day. Literally hundreds of people a day come through. We have a kollel of young marrieds learning there every day.
Nice.
Yes, it's beautiful. And the most beautiful thing is to come in here, go in the middle of the crazy concrete jungle, surrounded by shops, commercialism, fun, and walk in and hear the hum of learning. Even if you yourself are partaking in what's going on outside, which is fine too, it's really an oasis in the city. It's a calming place. It's a place of connection. And it's not just a spiritual place. It's also, like I said, a place where people come in and grab a coffee or just to see a friendly face. So we invite you to come by. And more than that, I feel like you, as my kindred spirit, have this incredible platform to use to assure women in particular that it's okay to take time for yourself and use your talents and abilities and incorporate them into the other areas of your life. And you can have a meaningful life and still be fashionable and still do interior design or be an artist or be an author and just incorporate all your talents. Now, some people tell me literally, like, I don't have a hobby or I don't collect anything. Start with one small thing. Read one small history book on the wherever city you're in. Buy a book on the history of your city. I always say that. You'll yes. be amazed what you'll learn. I will take a screenshot of some of my history books when I'll go somewhere and send it to the Chabad in some city that I read about. And they're like, are you serious? That building on my corner was once a synagogue?
Wow.
It's incredible. So it could be used in any capacity, but I encourage you to go buy a book on the history of the city that you're in.
I'm going to do that
today.
Probably
something small.
I'm ordering a book on Los Angeles. I mean, I'm literally right in the middle of everything.
Okay. When I went to Los Angeles, I went downtown. I went to that old street. I forgot what it's called to see the first settlers. The only thing is I laughed really hard because Los Angeles, the history goes to 1890 and my house is from 1860.
I know.
So Los Angeles, other than the missions by the
exactly.
Christians,
yes.
doesn't have that much history.
True.
But even that, who are the first Jews that went there? You know who? The movie industry.
Right.
Or the dry goods merchants. Most cities in the American, let's say Midwest or anywhere in America, Jewish peddlers.
Yes.
Were there. And then they built dry goods emporiums. And that's how most of the department stores today were originally Jewish owned, if they aren't still.
Right. No, it's
so
fascinating.
It's fascinating stuff, even about Jews, how they got to your city. Or Google that. Just Google Jews in Detroit or wherever you are.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
It's fascinating.
Well, Bracha Chana, thank you so much for joining us today. Listeners, make sure you check out her fascinating stories. You'll be sure to love them. I mean, they're so enjoyable. And next time you go to New York, you will have, you know, places to check out that are, you know, a little off the grid and have some historical value to them.
I just want to thank you for this platform. And I want to thank you for what you're doing to Jewish women. Very often we get stuck in our boxes, and it's great to have someone inspiring like you. I also have to tell you that when I first discovered you and your site, initially I thought it was just interior design.
Right.
With your fine and pink interior design career. And that's fine too. I was going to follow you for your interior design. And I started to realize those wheels are turning in your head. And I found a kindred spirit. And there's so much more to you than just design. And you also use design to enhance the lives of people, but you're such a layered
thank
person,
you.
Which
thank
is the
you.
Way I like a room and the way I like people. So
oh, I love that. That is the best compliment I've received. I will take it. And I had such a great time with you today.
Thanks a ton.
Thank you so much for listening in on our thoughtful, authentic conversation today. Stay tuned for next week's episode and make it a great one.